Silence.
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Pride Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 27 of Nerd Pride Radio. 27 as in Club 27, whose famous members include Robert Johnson, Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. I've actually submitted my own application to join, but no one's gotten back to me yet. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a history nerd, sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. We have a new sponsor this week. I am proud to welcome Aperture Science Technology to our Nerd Pride family. But there's no time to waste. Let's get straight to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. First thing on my master list, it's my gaming table.
You can't really call it a game. It was an obscenity.
I'm weaning.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I'm going to share it with you. Okay, here's the deal. On today's gaming table, I was going to talk about gamification. I was going to talk about the process of gamification, which is essentially taking any non-game activity and turning it into a game, okay? And this can be anything at all, but where you're seeing it a lot now is fitness programs. Go to the website Fitocracy, and they take fitness, exercise, general healthy living, and they turn it into a game where you earn points for various activities, I assume. I'm certainly not enough of an exercise nut to actually go there and look. But things like, earning Pepsi points. You trade in your Pepsi points for prizes. It turns drinking Pepsi into a game. Cigarette companies have done the same sort of thing. Credit cards offer you your frequent flyer miles or your other points towards earning whatever. I was going to go into this whole process and how technology has changed the process, and I actually just recorded about 5 minutes worth of stuff on it and realized that it was really, really dull and I didn't have much of a point. But what I will do is I'll take the best part of that and I'll share that with you on my gaming table, because where it was all leading me was to the Warrior Dash. Have you seen this thing? I love this. All right, this is taking a fitness challenge and turning it into a game. It's a sporting event in its own right. But Warrior Dash is a race, all right? And there are lots of places around the country where you can go participate in a Warrior Dash. There's one about 100 miles away from me coming up this summer. And I'm certainly not going to participate because it looks really, really hard. But I think Yancey might. I'll keep you posted on that. But here's the deal. With the Warrior Dash, they're turning this huge manly Viking Attila the Hun sort of competition, and you show up and there will be literally hundreds, maybe thousands of people showing up for this race. And in my particular area, it's a 3-mile course, and the course involves some running, some diving through the mud, some obstacles, climbing over walls, dodging under barbed wire, running through the tires. All sorts of clever stuff. There's lots of places where you have to balance across stuff, and it's very likely that you're going to get very muddy and very wet and very dirty. All right. So it's this huge, brutal obstacle course, 3 miles long. Potentially some people are going to finish this thing in, 40 minutes, probably a half hour. There's some people are going to take hours to get this done. Doesn't make any difference. When you get done with the Warrior Dash obstacle course, you're immediately rewarded with free beer and turkey legs to eat, because that's as manly as you can get, is chomping down on a turkey leg after something like this. And they give you a hat. They give you a Viking hat, all right? Or maybe it's a Hun hat. I don't even know. Either way, it's a fuzzy hat with horns on it, and it looks awesome, all right? And now, of course, you're paying a $50 entry fee, so you're paying them to punish you like this. But your reward is this huge beer festival afterwards, plus this hat. I just thought that's the coolest damn thing. All right, go to the Warrior Dash and just look at their website, and then take a look at the hat and think, you know you want to have that hat. You know you want to keep that on your desk, on your table, somewhere. Somewhere just prominent enough that you know it's going to be a conversation starter. All right? And someone who was at our workplace, as we're looking over the website, someone comes in and says, well, yeah, but, you know, you could just buy the hat for cheaper than that. And we're like, well, yeah, you could buy the hat, but who cares? I could buy the hat and it would look cool, but that doesn't give you the story. That doesn't give you the opportunity to just have it sitting there. Just set it off to the side and just wait, because you know everybody eventually is going to go, what's with the stupid hat? And then you get to tell the story. You get to tell the story of your adventure, right? And how you slogged through the mud and how you sweated and how you almost broke your arm going over that barrier wall and how you, it's just an awesome story. And you get to talk about the Warrior Dash. You get to talk about the party afterwards. This is a great gimmick. And that's what sells me on the entire thing. I'm sure there are lots of people who are participating in the Warrior Dash, and they're just thrilled with the competition and the chance to say that they've actually done it. But to me, it's about the hat. That's the selling point. I so love this concept. So that's where my gamification discussion leads me. It's just right into the Warrior Dash and how cool I think this concept is. Totally go check this thing out. And you know what? If anyone has ever participated in one of these, let me know. All right, we've just seen the concept, we've watched the videos. I've never actually talked to someone who's done it. So if you have, let me know. Or if you see one coming up and you're inspired by this and you're going to do it, oh, please let me know. This is great. So anyway, that's my gaming table for today. Next up, the science corner.
She blinded me with science.
That's right. If you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. All right, here, this is the greatest, and I heard this a while ago, and it keeps coming back, and I keep getting a little more detail on it, so finally I had to go do the research and find out what it's about. It is the concept of shared space in traffic. Shared space is it's actually capitalized, and it is a term for traffic management or city management. Shared space starts off with a headline. The first time you get introduced to it, it's always a headline that says, Germantown has done away with street signs. All right, that's the basic concept. In shared space, it is a concept of traffic management, city management. It involves not just vehicle traffic, but also bikes and pedestrians and anyone who shares the road. All right, and the idea is they just take away all the signs. They take away all the rules and regulations. They take away the signs. They take away everything, and all you're left with is road. And in fact, they've even gone so far that when you fully implement this concept, it's not just road, it's road, curb is gone, it's just road, sidewalk, all of the space is just all one big flat surface. And then off you go. And what they find is, without road signs, without street signs, without guidance, drivers are actually more careful, because God knows what maniacs can be coming around the next corner, right? And they find that in the shared space areas, it turns out that your speed is down. People are driving on average, you know, like 5 miles an hour slower than they normally would or 5 miles an hour slower than they would have under guided traffic with the actual signs there to tell them. Because what they found out is that when you've got the signs, at least this is the concept behind shared space. By the way, shared space developed by a Dutchman. It's always the Dutch, isn't it? His name was Hans Mondermann, or is Hans Mondermann. The guy's still alive. And the concept is, when you've got all those traffic signs, well, then you're going to do whatever the signs tell you, and it reduces your sense of responsibility. You feel like, you know what, you know where traffic's going, you know what the signs are telling you to do, you know everyone's supposed to be obeying the law, and therefore, your sense of responsibility, your sense of looking out for other people and seeing where everyone is, it's not as important. Because you trust in the signs and the little lines in the road and everything else. You trust those to take care of you. And without them, And they've implemented this in some places. Without them, they're finding that people have more eye contact with other drivers, more eye contact with pedestrians, actually negotiating your space with the other people around you, and people wind up being safer. Accidents rates drop. Go figure. All right? And this is just amazingly cool. A couple of Dutch towns did it first, the Dutch town of Makinga, and then Drachten after that. And my pronunciation in Netherlandese or whatever you guys speak is just awful, so don't hold me to any of that. Also, the city of Bamte. I even took high school German for 3 years, and I can't pronounce that at all. Some areas of West Palm Beach, Florida, so it's actually made it to the United States. Go figure. And again, everywhere that does it reports that, God, it's working really well. You know, speeds are down, accident rates are down, people are happier. I'm just amazed by this. Just floored. One of these, I think it's the Germantown, but maybe it's Drachten. I don't remember. Anyway, one of the towns is as big as 45,000 people. All right, that's bigger than the town I live in. And it's not huge to some of you, I get that, but 45,000 people is a significant sized town for the area. And with that number of people, imagine your town. Imagine any town you know of comparable size, and imagine no street signs. No street signs, no white lines, no yellow lines, no nothing. No guidance whatsoever. And pretty much, your only rules are stay to the right, and if you're blocking somebody else, you're going to get your car towed. That's pretty much it. So if you wind up leaving your car somewhere that you've now blocked in another car, or you've blocked off access to a building or whatever, all right, your car gets towed for that. Other than that, that's all the rules. And everything else is just don't be stupid. Holy crap. I'm just fascinated by this. All right? And here's the drawbacks. The drawbacks are people are claiming it won't work in larger cities. All right? Well, to me, 45,000 people is a pretty large city, but I understand what they mean. They're talking about once you get into larger spaces, it just, they're saying it's not feasible. And that sounds reasonable to me. And they also talk about, you know, having transition areas, because you have to go from the completely open shared space to guided traffic spaces, and so they'll have transition areas, because, you know, this is all only working in town where speeds are lower to start with, and you have the space, you have the visual link to make eye contact with other drivers, to actually communicate with them. You have the time for it, and you're within proximity to do that, whereas that kind of negotiation probably wouldn't work so well if you're doing 70 out on a major highway or interstate, and therefore you're not going to see who's coming in from the on-ramp or off-ramp. You're not going to be able to make negotiations like that. So they change things up. And the other complaint comes from bicyclists. Apparently bicyclists in some areas just are not thrilled by this, because they feel like the cyclists feel like they're in an inferior negotiating position when it comes to dealing with cars, and a lot of bicyclists get left on the curb because, rather than moving up like a car would and making eye contact and getting to a space where, okay, look, clearly it's my turn, I'm going. No, a lot of these cyclists wind up getting stuck on the edge, and they have to wait until someone stops for them and actually extends that invitation, actually reaches out to them and says, okay, it's your turn, go. And so they wind up getting stuck there forever, according to them. People on the other side are saying, well, that's just because you bike riders are being a bunch of namby-pambies, and you really need to get out there and be assertive just like everybody else. You know, make yourself known and negotiate. Do what you got to do. I don't know how valid any of that is on either side, but I know that that's the complaints. All right, here's my complaint. This is moving in completely the opposite direction from my fully automated traffic and car. This is moving in a direction away from me sitting in my car while it drives itself wherever it wants to go, and I watch Futurama on my iPod. Okay? So clearly, as much as this is an advance in development, and this is really some cool stuff, it's taking me away from my auto car, and I'm really kind of disappointed on that. Now, in my own personal life, I don't have any experience directly with shared space, all right? Clearly, to me, this is just a concept on the internet that I find fascinating. But I will tell you that the intersection right next to my home, we're talking about within a block of where I live, was the first roundabout in our area. Now, for people in Europe, you guys know roundabouts. You love roundabouts. You've been doing roundabouts for years. For us, This was completely new. This was the first one in my state, and it's right by my house. Now, to move from what we had before, which was an intersection with two stop signs, that was it. And to move to a roundabout, which just allows for a freer flow of traffic and does require a little eye contact, a little common sense. To me, I love the roundabout. I love the concept of it, and it has reduced speed in that, increased traffic flow, and made that intersection tons safer. I mean, before, I mean, and I'm not exaggerating about this at all. Prior to the roundabout by my house, what we had was a road that made an S-curve over a hill with a railroad track crossing with a blind corner because they had these tall bushes on the one side, and the bushes were on the railroad's property. So it wasn't even like I could complain to a neighbor, complain to the city. No, the railroad owned them, and the bushes just completely blocked view, at least when you come out from my house. So that's where the visual blockage was. Oh, yeah, and the whole thing was in a school zone. It was just a nightmare of an intersection. I lived with that for several years when I first moved here. I hated that intersection because it's the only way for me to get out is to sit at that stop sign and wait blindly and hope I didn't get hit getting out there. It's the only way for me to get to work if I didn't want to back up six blocks and go back around the other way. All right, so to me, the roundabout is a godsend. And to me, the shared space concept of traffic just is an extension of that, moving to a little more logical flow, a little more, I don't know. Anyway, I love the idea. I still want my auto car, but I would love to be in a town that has implemented the shared space. I would love to see that in action and see how it really works, because it just sounds cool to me. Which leads me into a nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
Hearing your voice every week, Gonzo, is just an extra little bit of joy for me. Thank you so much. In this nerd culture report, I have just been introduced to a website by Jeff Hawes. Thank you, Jeff. Called IO9. The letter I, letter O, number 9.com. IO9 is, to my mind at least, the ultimate nerd news site. The thing is unreal. Absolutely unreal. I love this thing. All right. The very first thing I saw on IO9, someone linked to a video that they were showing, and actually I think the video is out on YouTube, but it is Nathan Fillion and then Tim Daly, who does the voice of Superman and other people, and is Nathan Fillion as the voice of the Green Lantern, so therefore he has some knowledge. But Nathan Fillion playing himself, all right, I have said Nathan Fillion about 13 times. I've really got to start rehearsing these things. He comes in and he does an intervention with Tim Daly, voice of Superman, and it's just hysterical. Great, great video, all right? And so I see this through IO9, and so I start browsing around. And then shortly thereafter, Jeff Hawes sends me another link. He sends this from a private message, but sends me another link to IO9, saying, dude, you really need to talk about this on the podcast, all right? And it was talking about Star Trek transporters and Star Trek warp drive technology, with warp drive specifically. Again, fascinating article. Here's the thing. You go to IO9 and go to their front page, and it's news reports on new technology, news reports on science fiction, and then you know how much I love my TV, my movies, my just sci-fi nerd media, all right? Whether it's superheroes or Star Trek or Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or any of the stuff that we love. And it's all over the site. And the whole thing is just, it's slick and well packaged. Here, real quick, I'm going to go to the internet and I'm going to go to io9.com. There's my bookmark. And I haven't looked today because it's been a busy weekend. But let's see what's on the front page, just real quick. Oh, wow. See, this is Good Night Tatooine. This weekend, we bade a sad farewell to Ralph McQuarrie, the artist who designed the visual look of the Star Wars universe. And, oh, see? Right off. And it's got this gorgeous, gorgeous picture of the twin suns over Tatooine. Either some concept art from the original Star Wars, something like that. Because there's the land speeder. I assume that's Luke standing there. This is great. All right. But just rolling down the front page today. All right. Simon Pegg joins Boba Fett's all-star bounty hunter team, and we become a DC nation. I have no idea what's going on in there. It looks like multiple things being covered in that article, but every bit of it right up my alley. Innovative manga using pencil and paper to create 3D comic. Breakthrough technology turns filthy sewage into clean energy. The psychedelic physics behind lava lamps. I own a lava lamp. I just got one for Christmas. Love my lava lamp. All right. Every single thing on here, exactly designed, tickle my interest, and they do such a good job of it. So my recommendation to all of you, everyone listening, never, ever visit this website. Absolutely. Do not go to IO9. It is a waste of your time. And what will happen is you will wind up going to IO9. You will enjoy all of their articles. You will learn. You will become smarter. And then you'll come listen to my podcast, and you'll realize that, crap, this is where half my ideas are coming from now. I won't be able to present anything new to you because you will have already seen it. I mean, at this point, if you're following the three webcomics that I follow daily, plus Cracked.com, plus Talk to Yancey and Joel in my office, there's pretty much 90% of my ideas already. So, seriously, you go to IO9, it's just going to pull back the curtain a little too far. Don't go. It's not worth your time. Trust me, if there's anything interesting, I'll bring it to you, okay? You guys can trust me, right? All right, we're good. Also, turns out I've been thinking about TV lately.
Kids today, so desensitized by movies and television.
Look, I don't care what the telly says, all right? We have to get out of here.
This is one time where television really fails to capture the true excitement.
You believe everything you hear on TV?
Yep, this is my As Seen on TV segment. I haven't decided on a bumper clip for that one yet, so who knows what's going to be in that empty space. Could be anything. Your guess is as good as mine. I've been thinking about miniseries on television. I love the concept of the miniseries. I just don't care much for the execution. Well, one, because, all right, originally this question was going to be, whatever happened to the miniseries in the U.S.? The United States miniseries just seems to have disappeared, and then it turns out that, oh, no, I only think that because I don't have HBO. Yeah, see, there's my problem. Yeah, miniseries never went away. They just moved to HBO and Showtime and other places that can afford to do that kind of artistic stuff because their audience is a little bit different. Here's the deal. A miniseries is anything that's just not a full run of a series, all right? Rather than, a full 13 episodes for a half season, 26 episodes for a full season, a miniseries is anything that is shorter than that in general, all right? Typically when I was growing up, I remember, four nights in a row or six episodes or whatever it would be. Everyone remembers Roots, or at least everyone who's my age remembers Roots. Roots was just an event, and I never saw any of it, but everyone was talking about it when it was on, or at least all the adults were. My parents never would let me watch it at that age. But they kind of disappeared, at least in my, my circles. The things that I'm aware of, I haven't watched a miniseries in ages. And it turns out that, they've moved to the pay channels, and miniseries now, and in the U.S., always kind of have been, they tend to be these grand epics, these huge things. It's like Roots, or Lonesome Dove, The Thornbirds, a decade ago or so they did Pride and Prejudice. Nowadays it's John Adams, or it's, whatever else. It's these huge, epic, often historical things, and they typically are based on a book or series of books, and again, these huge, lavish, grand items. Now, for me, the ones I've seen in the last few years that I really enjoyed, and it's all on Roku, thank God for Roku, but I saw Jekyll, British miniseries, six episodes, spectacular. The acting in it is wonderful, the story is engaging. I love Jekyll. 6 hours of solid entertainment. And then also, what was that sci-fi one? I can't even remember the name for sure. Was it The Room? Hang on. I'm gonna go check out that. Oh, holy crap. It was The Lost Room. I cannot believe it took me that long to find it. That was ridiculous. Anyway, it wasn't even that relevant, but it was a great miniseries. If you've got a chance to watch The Lost Room, watch it. Really, really good. The ending, a little messed up because they clearly intended this to become a series or some ongoing thing, and it didn't work out that way. But either way, totally worth your time to watch it. All right, but here's the deal. I wish regular American television was more willing to work in the miniseries format. Network television, cable television, not the pay channels. Because it doesn't, to me, I would love to see stuff that was more stuff that gives you a limited, specific story arc, but doesn't have to have the massive production values of an epic movie. For example, Heroes. I loved Heroes off and on. And Heroes was intended from day one. Their original intention was you were going to get this first season was going to be a single run of a comic book. And when it got to the end and we got the story of all of those characters, we'd be done. Season two would start. We'd maybe have one carryover character, maybe two, give us a little continuity. But essentially, start over with a new batch of heroes, a new batch of villains, a whole new concept and plot, new characters to develop and follow. And I so wish they had done that. I think the downfall of Heroes for me, I mean, it came back at points. There were good stuff in and out of it. But they had so much contrived stuff because when you've got ongoing heroes in this sort of situation, and they built up, some of these guys built them up to godlike levels. Okay, well, now what do we have to contrive to get them back to a manageable level for the next episode or the next season? Or how are we going to handle them? And they shoehorned all these characters in so many different roles that it kind of lost some of its impact by the end. And I wish they'd gone with that original concept. What's wrong with the idea of having a specific story arc to go, you know, we know when we start that here's what we're going to do. Lost. If Lost hadn't been so messed up by everyone involved, really, but they had this original concept, and had they worked it out properly ahead of time, they could have set it down as a three-season run with a very specific story arc that goes, you know, they know exactly what they're going to do. Is that, right, first season, we set up all the mystery. Second season, we deal with the others. Third season, we move into whatever. Boom, finale, we're ready. Okay, they could have done that. But no, we have American TV producers in both cases who say, yeah, but we want to give the audience more of what they like, and we want to stretch this out for as long as possible. All right, yeah, Lost, originally they planned on 4 seasons or 5. But the producers said, but we can go longer, right? You guys can add some more into this. You can, and they made it more confused. And there's some people who say, you know, they didn't have a real direction anyway to start with, so it was all made up. But I'm one that believes that, no, they kind of knew where they were going. They had something in the beginning, but they added so many elements because they really had no definitive end that they just ruined it. All right, Heroes had a great idea that we're going to do this set of heroes this year. Next season, we'll do a whole new set. And turns out that, but people like Heroes so much. People like these characters so much. Claire, we can't let the cheerleader go now. We're just getting to know her. And they wanted to keep following the same characters. That they thought that's what the audience was demanding, and maybe they were. So that's what we do, is we do an ongoing story when really it wasn't built for that ongoing story. It wasn't designed that way. That's not what they had in mind. It was just disappointing. Now, I know, in both of those concepts, I'm not talking about mini-series per se, but I'm talking about a limited series. All right, and that's what I'm looking at. Can't we do, a series that focuses on a specific set of characters for, 6 episodes, and then you have a little bit of continuity? It's set in the same world, or there's a carryover character that falls in it, like Sandman did for comic books. I mean, that was a great concept. We have Sandman as an ongoing series, and we have the Sandman himself and his family as kind of the overarching concept that ties it all together. They are the thread that runs through everything, and yet Sandman ran in very specific story arcs that we would run, 3 episodes, 4 episodes, 6 episodes, whatever it was for this comic book. And so you would get a solid whole story, beginning to end, boom, enough to fill their graphic novel, and now, hey, let's move on to our next story. I love that idea. And I so wish American television could do more of that sort of thing. I wish we could, and again, because of the way a limited series is broadcast and thus advertised, it's required for American television, at least, that you need something to draw people in. You need to make it a huge event. If you want to get people to watch your miniseries, then, okay, it needs to be based on a book with a recognizable author, or it just be a recognizable book to start with, so that when you advertise it, that's what's going to draw people in. So they know that, oh, my God, it's from this guy. They know what they're getting, and that'll draw the people in. Or because you're going to run it, 4 or 5 nights in a row. And so you have to have that epic quality, those big production values. You have to do all of that just to get people in front of it. Because otherwise, it's tough to drag people into a new series anyway, much less a new series that's only going to be here for a few days. And if I miss an episode, well, screw it. I missed it anyway. Let's get out. So I get that that's why they do it. But I think within the framework of a full series, like I say, like Sandman, or like Heroes originally conceived itself to be, you could have a set framework And then build your miniseries stories into that, and the viewers will keep coming back every week because they know they're getting a quality story. They know they're getting something interesting. And hey, if you didn't like this couple of episodes, don't worry. We're going to start something new in just a minute. It'll be on the same theme that we know you love, but we'll do something new with it. I don't know. I just feel like American television is so limited anymore, and I know there's good stuff out there. There's always new good stuff. My Roku is proof of that. And that's another good point. Because of Roku, because of the internet, because of how we consume our television nowadays, there's so many people who don't bother to watch episodes as they come out. So many people who are picking up series after they're already done. They already have seen the reviews. They know how good it was. Great. Let's go pick it up and watch it. And that's where they're getting a lot of their viewership anymore. And I think this could lend itself to more what I'm talking about. More, you know, there's plenty of episodic shows that I have enjoyed. Star Trek is a great example of an episode, especially Next Generation, which was my favorite Star Trek. You know, a great example of an episodic show that I really liked, that each episode is self-contained. You know, each episode tells you a full story. You can watch them out of order most of the time, and it's not going to make any bit of difference. Great. There's episodic shows I can really enjoy. But I love the continuing storyline. I love the idea that the entire series, or this entire chunk of the series, is one grand tale on the order of, you know, an 8-hour movie or whatever it's going to be. I love that, and I wish we could develop more of that without having to turn into Lost or having to turn into, you know, Heroes Season 2. It's so disappointing that that we get so much of that. So I think I've made my point. I'm just babbling for the sake of hearing myself at this point. Let's keep moving. Oh no, get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back. And I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage. Okay, should you be allowed to use social networking at work? Facebook, Twitter, whatever. And in general, the answer is, well, no, of course not. There's no good reason that you need to be on Facebook at work. I completely agree. There's no reason I need to be on Facebook at work. They shouldn't let me do it. Great. But what if you're a parole officer? What if you're a social worker? What if going on Facebook actually means that you can gather evidence about the people that you work with, all right? Verify their claims. I mean, like I say, in the case of social work, I mean, we're talking about people who are providing benefits for all sorts of reasons, and people will make lots of outlandish claims on their application forms in order to get government money. But you know what? They're all stupid enough to put all their dirty secrets right out there on Facebook. And if I, as a social worker, could sit at my desk, and I'm not a social worker, but I've been one before, if I could sit at my desk and I could just punch up their names on Facebook and see that they are no privacy settings, no nothing. They just post right out in the open that, yes, they made their application with me and they mentioned that, yes, they're single, dad's run off, we don't even know where he's living anymore. And yet right there on Facebook, you're posting a picture showing that he's living there in the house with you. You're clearly trying to defraud the government, and the evidence is right there. And yet social workers are not allowed to use Facebook at work. He's not around here. What a shame. All right, parole officer. This is my favorite because I know a parole officer, and he winds up having to check up on some of his clients at home on Facebook because his office won't let him do it at work. And in fact, they've chewed him out for bringing in Facebook evidence, even though it's wound up resulting in sending dudes to jail who are into some really, really evil, evil stuff. All right, people who will post up pictures of themselves, talk about gross violations of their parole, drug use, drinking, commission of crimes, stuff that is just terrible and clearly in violation of the terms of their parole, clearly stuff that needs to get them sent back to prison. And in many of these cases, the guy gets the evidence there at home and sends them back to prison because that's where these people need to be. And his office tells him that, yeah, no, we couldn't let you do that at work, though, because, well, if we let everyone have Facebook, some people might abuse it. Well, no kidding, some people might abuse it. So what? Then you deal with that as a damn supervisor. You step in and you take action rather than just saying, well, the simplest way is just don't let anyone have it. Yes, let's take away all their tools because someone might abuse it. infuriates me. I had a conversation about this earlier in the week with the guy in question, who, again, is actually a parole officer and has actually been through all of this. And I made some comment about using Facebook. He's like, well, no, I can't do that at work. I'm like, what? Really? And now I can't get this out of my head all week long. I keep coming back to it. Every time I check my own Facebook at night, I'm like, how can he not be allowed to check Facebook? How can he not be allowed to follow up on his clients? This is so clearly work-related, so vital, potentially, to what he does. How can you not? It's just idiocy. It is just idiocy to take away. I mean, look, I understand. I understand the internet itself is such a tempting waste of time. And I know that if you give people free access to internet in the workplace, the vast majority of people will abuse it in some way during work hours. I get that. But the trick is, are they getting their job done? Is their time waster, you know, if they go spend 15 minutes checking their personal email and looking at their Facebook page, is that any worse than the guy who, you know, stands in the break room with his cup of coffee for 45 minutes chatting with somebody else? Is it any worse than the gal who spends all her time on the phone gossiping with someone else? And I say gal just because I say guy in the first one. I'm not making any specific assertion about who's more of a gossip than anyone else. All right, people waste time in all sorts of ways. The internet is just such an obvious one. Such an obvious temptation that workplaces just, they want to block everything. And you know what? You want to block game sites? That's great. You know, you want to block certain things? I understand that. You want to block even Facebook for the majority of your employees? Awesome. All right? But for the people who do need it, let them have it. For people who need the internet for other stuff, real work-related stuff, for God's sake, don't shut down everything. What is wrong with you? This is, all right. I could go on about this for a long time, but I'm not gonna, because there, I've gotten it out. And I know you all agree with me, right? We don't have any managers in the audience, do we? All right, I think we're good. So let's try out the badass movie quote of the week. Quote, try to imagine yourself in the Cretaceous period. You get your first look at this 6-foot turkey as you enter the clearing. He moves like a bird, lightly, bobbing his head. You keep still because you think maybe his visual acuity is based on movement like the T-Rex. He'll lose you if you don't move. But no, not Velociraptor. You stare at him, and he just stares right back. And that's when the attack comes. Not from the front, but from the side. Whoosh. From the other two raptors, you didn't even know were there because Velociraptor is a pack hunter, you see. He uses coordinated attack patterns, and he's out in force today. He slashes at you with this 6-inch retractable claw, like a razor on the middle toe. He doesn't bother to bite your jugular like a lion. No, no. He slashes at you here, or maybe across the belly, spilling out your intestines. The point is, you're alive when they start to eat you. So, you know, try to show a little respect. That's Sam Neill as Dr. Grant in Jurassic Park. I'm sorry. End quote. I should have said that. Anyway, all right, Jurassic Park has become such a cliche since it came out. It's been mocked in so many different ways. It's had horrible, horrifying sequels to it. I know that. But go back and watch the original Jurassic Park, and this is a good movie. It holds up really well. Now, watching it now, I have some issues with it. They telegraph their punches so far ahead in this one. They get so preachy on the whole, you know, messing in the realm of God business. Or, you know, do we have a right to do whatever? I don't know. All right. So they get a little preachy. But I remember when I went and saw this in the theater back in 1993, for God's sake. This movie is almost 20 years old. That just kills me. And when I went and saw it in the theater, I remember those discussions, and I remember thinking, oh, well, clearly something's going to go wrong. But I didn't see it coming. All right? Have I talked about Jurassic Park on the podcast before? Because if not, this just floors me. You've all seen Jurassic Park. You know what I'm talking about. You know what kind of vicious horror movie this really truly is. All right? We're all agreed on that point. Back in 1993, I swear to God, they marketed it as a kid's movie. Or at least, they marketed this movie as a movie that, if you were watching these ads, it seemed perfectly safe to bring children to. All right, my wife and I went to see this movie, and this is when we were just first dating. All right, we went to see Jurassic Park because from the ads didn't show the velociraptors. The ads didn't show the horror. The ads didn't show any of that. They clearly made a very specific, concerted effort to scare the crap out of you when you got there because they didn't tell you what was coming. You didn't even know you were watching a horror movie until it was too late. Yeah, imagine that. Try getting away with that nowadays with all the advanced trailers and all the warnings that we get. I can't even imagine doing it. But in 1993, yeah, that's exactly right. They showed these trailers with a happy Jurassic Park. Oh, look, it's dinosaurs. Honest to God, they did. Right? And it looked like it's a story, a kid's tale of a Disney-style dinosaur theme park. What could be nicer? All right? And then we got in there, and the T-Rex bit a dude in half. Oh, my God, did not see that coming. My wife and I had thought about taking her little brother and sister with us to this movie. We wound up not doing it, and thank God for that, because they were, well, I can't even remember, let's see, we were first dating, so they would have been like 7 and 10, 8 and 11, something like that. They were young, way too young to see this film. And then the movie proceeded to simply scare the crap out of you. Now, again, the movie telegraphs a lot of the stuff ahead of time, and I'm kind of oblivious, so I didn't see it coming. And in fact, the quote I just gave you of Sam Neill describing what a raptor attack might be like, right? He describes a raptor attack. He makes it vicious and bloody and painful. And I know that there's going to be live dinosaurs later in the movie. It never once occurred to me that that was foreshadowing. It never once occurred to me that, oh my God, this is, oh, by the way, if you haven't seen the movie before, this whole thing, spoilers, sorry. You know what? It's 20 years old. Too late. Didn't see it coming at all. All right. So, having said all that, and the brilliant, deceptive, lying marketing campaign that went along with this film, and how much I enjoy the film, and how much I think it is a classic, and I think it's a really quality film. Really do. We just saw it recently. This is why it all comes up. Just saw it a week ago or so. And we invited my 8-year-old. Now, I know I just said 8-10 years old is way too young to watch this movie. And I know that. Right? But we invited my 8-year-old to come watch with us if he felt like it. And he said, well, is it scary? And to my chagrin, I went, it's a movie about a dinosaur park. Come on, let's watch. All right, see? I'm evil. All right. And so we snuggle in, and we watch, and it got to the first scene that got scary. I mean, he was fascinated with this movie. He was having a great time, asking all sorts of questions. He was thrilled to see that the bad guy from Toy Story 2 was in it. And he's like, oh, my God, it looks just like him. I'm like, well, yeah, because it is him. Toy Story 2, they based Al. They actually drew him to look exactly like this guy. That's why he looks like Al. It is Al. And anyway, it gets to the scene where, okay, everything starts to go wrong. It starts to get dark. He senses clearly that something's going badly here. And we're like, oh, just hang on. Let's watch. I'm like, hey, they're going to be all right. I promise. Well, then the T-Rex breaks in, knocks everything over. It's the scariest stuff ever. I mean, the tension in this is just brilliant. They really did a good job. And then the one guy makes a break for it. He gets to the bathroom. The T-Rex knocks the bathroom over, bites the dude in half. And that's when my 8-year-old said, yeah, I'm out of here. I'm done. And I mean, he was mad. He was so mad at us. But we did, I mean, again, this was him watching with both of his parents. You know, we were there to talk him through it. And once he said he was leaving, we're like, all right, you know, cool. But let us tell you that while it's scary, it's him that dies and there's, you know, bad guys die. But by the end of the movie, I said, all the people you care about, the kids, the doctors, even you know, the crazy Kentucky Fried Chicken looking guy who runs the place, I said, all of them will live by the end of the movie. It's going to be scary for them. They're going to get chased, and they're going to get beat up a little bit, and they're going to be scared. But trust me, they all live. It's really okay. And he's like, oh, all right, well, then I'm fine with it. Do you want to sit and watch the rest? No, I don't. All right, well, off you go. And he's fine. But in talking about it afterwards, my wife and I said, you know what? Kind of happy that bothered him. Kind of happy that we have raised a child who isn't comfortable watching Jurassic Park at 8 years old. I think that's a good sign. And now, maybe you guys don't have kids. Maybe you don't know. Most kids that I know who are 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old. Most of them have seen Jurassic Park multiple times and love it. Most of them have seen Friday the 13th movies. Most of them have seen the Child's Play movies. Most of them have seen, they watch horror movies. I've had 11-year-olds start relating details of Saw to me because they've watched the Saw movies. Like, you're kidding. Really? It just floors me that these kids have seen all of this. I don't know if it's because their parents let them or if it's because their parents don't monitor or if, you know. And now I understand, you know, different people have different philosophies, but for me, some of that stuff is just a little too severe. I'm not comfortable with, especially, you know, something like Saw, the torture violence kind of horror movie. I'm not comfortable with that for my kids, at least not at that age. You know, get them to 14, 15, 16. All right, yeah, we can talk about that. We can have a good time watching those movies at that point. But for little kids, I'm just amazed at how many of them have seen that stuff. So, again, with the kind of jaded elementary school kids that I'm familiar with through, you know, through school, through scouts, through other activities, I'm just relieved that my son seems to be, you know, he has a healthy fear and respect for this sort of movie. And you know what? He knows he's not ready for it. He'd rather go do something else right now. I'm like, all right, that's cool. You go off and do it, kid. So what do you think? You guys want me to bring out R2? All right, I think it's about time. Maybe we should do a little Pod-O-Matic. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, you need to send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. I will add your requests to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic, it's about whatever you want it to be. This first number is 48. This one comes from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul, again, going crazy with the submissions. I think it is his goal to get his entire own Pod-O-Matic episode. You may be getting close, Paul. Sirius Paul says, how do you like your burgers? All right. I like my burgers medium well. I like all of my steaks medium well. I like just a tiny bit of pink inside. That's what I like. All right. Actually, and my steaks I actually like more medium to medium rare sometimes, but it depends on the mood. But a burger, medium well, and I'm pretty simple on my burgers. When I'm making them at home especially, we usually just throw on a little cheese, a little ketchup, a little Miracle Whip. I'm good. That's a burger for me. But I'm not terribly picky. I mean, you get me out to a good restaurant, and I'll be happy to try out your bacon burger. I'll be happy to try out your new Chipotle barbecue chicken, whatever. I don't care what you put on it. All right? Give me a burger. Slap some stuff on it. Let's have fun. Well, okay, no vegetables. It's just like my pizzas. All right? I'm not real thrilled with the onions or the peppers or the lettuce or the tomatoes or the... All right, but although... Wait. Crispy onions are good, though. All right, you give me a restaurant that'll throw an onion ring on there or some of the crispy onions or something like that. The breaded fried onions, the ones that make it less vegetable and more, you know, greasy breading. Good stuff. But, I just like a good burger. I'm not complaining. Number 42. I have one from Zimney Pot. Zimney says, you are at the doctor's office, and she has just informed you, all right, I don't know which doctor this is because my doctor's a dude, or at least my new doctor's a dude, my general practitioner. But clearly, I've gone to a specialist for purposes of this question because it's a chick. So, anyway, she has just informed you that you have approximately 1 month to live. A, do you tell anyone, everyone, that you're going to die? B, what do you do with your remaining days? C, would you be afraid? All right. A, do I tell everyone that I'm going to die? God, yes. I would tell everyone I'm going to die. Do you know why? Because they're going to know anyway. B, what would you do with your remaining days? All right. Depends on what a month to live means. If there is some chance that treatment is going to prolong my life in some way, or if there's a possibility, I mean, prolong it significantly. I mean, if you're talking about I'm going for chemotherapy because it might give me another 2 weeks, well, clearly, it's not worth my time. But if treatment is going to extend my life, and there's a chance that it could significantly extend my life, well, probably my remaining days would be spent with treatment. But also, other than that, obviously, I'm just going to spend time with my family. I mean, that's really, really what it would be all about. I have a beautiful, wonderful, supportive wife. I have four bright, intelligent, good-looking, fun young sons. I would spend as much time with them as humanly possible, which I already spend an awful lot of time with all of them anyway because I love them that much. But, yeah, if I'm going to die, yeah, I want my family around me. All right, I would probably wind up, you know, making sure that I either get to see my family that lives far. I've got a lot of family in Texas. That's where most of my family lives. I would make sure I get to see them. Probably, actually, they have the money. They can come up and see me. But I would want to make sure I get to see all of them. It's all about family for me at that point. And then C, would you be afraid? Oh, hell yes, I'd be afraid. Fear, the fear of the pain, the fear of the end, the fear of what you're leaving behind for everyone else here. Of course, there would be all sorts of fear. Fear that I'm not going to be able to handle this with dignity. Fear that I, you know, who knows what. Yes, there would be tons of fear. And hopefully my month or however long I wind up getting would be long enough to get past that to some point of acceptance so I could at least enjoy what I had left. But who knows? Oh, that question took it out of me. Let's try something else. Number 55. This one is from Sirius Paul. Again, told ya. In a battle between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Jet Li from The One, who wins? Wow. All right, I have not seen The One. I don't know if that's shameful or not, but I haven't. But I'm going to tell you right now, Jet Li would have to win because, well, by definition, he's The One. You don't beat The One, all right? In any version of Star Wars that includes Obi-Wan Kenobi, is Obi-Wan The One? No, his name sounds a little like one, but it's Wan, all right? And so, therefore, he's not the one. Anakin's the one. Luke is the one, but not Obi-Wan. No, but Jet Li's the one. He wins. Oh, number 99. All right, this one is from the gorgeous Nadia. And Nadia says, I heard that you learned binary numbers when you were 7 years old. Is binary your favorite number system? Why, what an excellent question. You know what? I did learn binary numbers when I was about 7 years old. My dad taught them to me on a camping trip, which I thought they were fascinating. I didn't quite understand them. I understood how to figure them. I understood what he was talking about. But the full import of the concept of binary numbers just didn't really catch on until a couple years later. When I was in maybe fourth grade, then we started doing base four stuff in the math class I was in, which was me by myself. And once I did base four, I went, oh, that's where it all went, and it all clicked for me. And I loved base four. Base four was my favorite number system for a long time because it was so simple. And it was, here's the deal. Binary, base two, it's a pain in the butt. I understand that it's machine language. I understand it is the most basic number system. It's the most universal number system because you can't really argue about base 2. It's base 2. It's the simplest number system you get. But it also means that if I want to do calculations with it and I'm not using a machine to do them, oh, every number is a million digits long. That's a pain in my butt. All right? So what do I like for number systems? Four had some appeal early on because it was the first one I learned other than 10 that I really, the concept clicked completely for me. But even 4 is a little too small, a little too simple. I think I would prefer either base 8 or base 16, all right, octadecimal or hexadecimal. And let me tell you why. Because I think 8 and 16, both as multiples of 2, powers of 2, they are closer to binary, closer to machine language. So therefore, I read a story, God, it might even have been a Heinlein story. I don't remember. It was a cat story. I remember that. Maybe not the cat who walked through walls, but it was the cat. Maybe it was the cat who walked through walls. I think that was a Heinlein story. I don't remember who it was. Doesn't make any difference. Anyway, in this, there wound up being parallel universes, and they wound up getting to a single universe where you got multiple copies of people from all these different universes. So you get multiple copies of Stephen Hawking, for example. Some of them in a wheelchair, some of them not, depending on how far his disease had progressed in that particular world. But you wound up with all these people together in this same place where they had created whatever this author's version of paradise was at the time. And in this perfect world, apparently physicists were reigning supreme in this place because, well, it was the physicists mostly who were able to get to it. And so they're creating a world where ordinary people, for their day-to-day activities, all learned base 8. They all learned octadecimal because it was close to base 10. It let you use, you know, fewer digits. You didn't have to, you know, write out, you know, 19 digits in a row just to represent your grocery bill or whatever. But as octadecimal, it was something that was manageable for the brain, and yet easier to convert to base 2. So therefore, when you have to convert your numbers into computer language, you actually wind up creating a greater efficiency, less waste of digits, less waste of calculations to go from base 2 to base 8 and vice versa than converting to base 10. So does this make any sense? All right. That's what they did. And that idea has always appealed to me. The idea that, oh, yeah, you know what? If the whole world worked in base 8, all of our conversions to computer language, all of our conversions to binary would be so much simpler. God, that is kind of cool. Now, hexadecimal, base 16, would actually be even easier for the conversions, I think. But base 16 is tough because, crap, you have to remember an extra 6 digits. And when you have to learn your multiplication tables, if you want to do calculations on your own, if you want to do calculations without a machine, well, now your multiplication tables go out to 16. You minimum, you have to learn your tables out to 16, or else you can't do basic math on your own. All right? Learning the addition tables would not be so tough, but learning the multiplication tables, much, much harder. Base 8 would be so much easier to memorize. So I like the two of them. I think I like base 8 a little bit more just for that reason. I've actually, now that I'm having this conversation, if I sound a little distracted, it's because I'm thinking about them going, God, could I learn the multiplication tables in base 8 and base 16? I think I could. I should try that. I think that would be really fun. See if I could start doing manual multiplication and division in either of those. That would be really cool. So, anyway, if I ever try that, I will let you guys know. But I'm sure this is just a pipe dream because all this just came into my head. And by tomorrow, I'll look back at it and go, yeah, I'm not doing that. Seriously, I got better things to do with my time. Number 86, Sirius Paul. What happened to Captain Britain? Well, I don't know. Did he go away? I don't follow comics anymore. I have no idea. Dude. I mean, last I knew of Captain Britain, he was in Excalibur, and that was, I don't know, 15 years ago. So I didn't know he disappeared. Although, I will tell you that there is some kids' cartoon that's on in the morning. I don't know if you've seen Superhero Squad. And I'm sure, actually, this cartoon is actually part of the Superhero Squad cartoon. I'm sure it's just one of their segments. If you've seen Superhero Squad, it is the kids' version of Marvel superhero action figures, the little kids' version with the oversized bobbleheads and the big feet and hands. It's those characters in their own cartoon. So it's a simplified superhero thing for, you know, 5-year-olds. And one of the segments they run is a team of captains. And now, I haven't actually watched a whole episode. I've just seen the show on the screen when my 5-year-old is watching it. So I don't actually know what the plot is. I don't know what's going on. All I know is that Captain America is there. Captain Britain is there. And then Captain Canada is there. Do you know who Captain Canada is? Yeah, it's Wolverine wearing a maple leaf costume, playing Captain Canada. And then there's a couple others. I don't know if it's Captain Germany. I don't know if it's Captain Brazil. I have absolutely no clue. It could be Captain Uruguay or Captain Israel, for all I know. I wasn't paying attention. All I know is I saw Wolverine with the maple leaf, and I was just thrown. So I know Captain Britain is still there, or at least if they're still making new episodes of that. I also realized now I haven't seen any new episodes or any episodes of that for at least a few months. Ooh, wow, they may be done with Superhero Squad. So I don't know. I don't know what happened to Captain Britain. Number 67. Sirius Paul. We get it, Paul. You love writing into the podcast. I so appreciate you. Paul says, what's the funniest movie you've ever seen? Oh, it changes. It changes over time. I really have no idea at this moment. I mean, look, just flat out funny. Just straight up funny. At the time I saw it, American Pie was the funniest thing ever. All right? But also, at the time I saw it for the first time, Animal House was the funniest movie ever. All right? And you're going to see a theme in some of these, because American Pie, Animal House, The Hangover, all right, a little bit different concept, but something about Mary. These were movies that when I saw them the first time ever, I laughed and I laughed and I laughed. All right, consistently funny over time. I don't know, hard to say. I mean, like I say, these are movies that made me laugh nonstop, beginning to end, the first time I saw them, and I love them for that. All right, but I'm trying to think of comedy movies that I still watch repeatedly, because there's again, I have a stable of movies that I will watch repeatedly for very various reasons. And very few of those are comedies. But I will tell you that Galaxy Quest is technically a comedy, and I've watched that dozens of times. I love Galaxy Quest. But again, I don't love it for the comedy so much, although it is a very funny movie in its way. I watch it for the ironic Star Trek factor. I watch it for the performances. I watch it for a lot of reasons. But I think it's a funny movie. I hate to admit it, Liar Liar. Oh, I love that movie. Again, it's a movie I saw with my wife in the theater. I saw it for my birthday when it first came out years and years ago. And at the time, and I understand critics since then have all said that Liar Liar is not a great movie. It's lumped in with all these other Jim Carrey monstrosities. So I get that it's not a great movie. I understand that on an intellectual level. But in my gut, I laughed so hard that first time we saw it. I loved the movie so much that first time, and I've never gotten that out of my head. And I've seen the movie, you know, easily 10 times since then, and I still love it every time. There's something about it. I am just completely sold on that movie. All right, maybe it's a dumb Jim Carrey vehicle. I can't tell. I have blinders on. Hysterical movie. I'm sorry, Paul. I'm not answering your question because, like I say, it changes. Because, you know, American Pie, hysterical the first time I saw it, not so much on repeated viewings. Animal House, hysterical on the first time I saw it, and the thing holds up really well over time. That one's a good candidate, maybe, for my funniest movie ever. Most of the others, you know, Hangover, I've only seen the one time. Something About Mary, I find unwatchable now. Spectacular the first time through, unwatchable ever since. So, you know, it varies. Number 22, Stan. Stan says, what was the point of trying to be cool in school? Did it get us anywhere? Oh, God, no. No, it didn't. No, I so wish I hadn't even bothered. Although, well, again, this is me being all philosophical about it. Clearly, if I hadn't made those efforts, I wouldn't, you know, if I hadn't tried so hard to fit in, if I hadn't tried so hard to hide what a nerd I was, I wouldn't have learned any lessons about being myself. I wouldn't have learned that those things don't work. I wouldn't have learned that, hey, that's not what's going to fulfill me. I wouldn't have, you know, there's all sorts of stuff in there. But you know what? Again, as I've said, I guess my own kids, in a lot of ways, at least my oldest so far, has skipped a lot of those lessons. And he's just gone straight into, hey, he's always been accepting of who he is. You know, for the most part. Everyone's got their issues. But for the most part, he skipped over a lot of that. And it turns out that he can be a nerd and just be himself and be accepted and be cool about that. I wish I could have done that. I wish I hadn't made so many efforts way back when to sweep my nerdiness under the rug. But again, a lot of that was a different day and age. All right. Back then, being a nerd wasn't chic. Today, I mean, while nerds may still be picked on, they may still have problems, they may still be socially unacceptable in a lot of situations, there's some prejudice. Not, you know, it's not like having to be black or gay or Latino or, you know, some other truly oppressed minority, but being a nerd is sometimes not a picnic. But there is, in popular culture at least, a nerd chic going on, a nerd revolution that gives you a little more credit, you know? So, yeah, it's a different day. But I guess, again, the actual question is, what was the point of trying to be cool in school? Did it get us anywhere? No, it didn't. I wish I didn't have to go through all of that. I wish I could have just been myself, enjoyed my stuff, and I wouldn't have sold all my D&D stuff at a garage sale. Oh, damn, I was a fool. Number 9 from, oh, guess who? Can you guess? If you guess Serious Paul, you're right. Serious Paul says, have you ever fired a firearm? Tell us about it. Oh, of course I have. Well, I say of course as if everybody in the world has. All right, I have. I've shot guns on many, many an occasion. And I've never actually shot a living thing. I've never been a hunter, never gone hunting, never really wanted to go hunting. I have no urge. I really, because, again, for me, it's like fishing, all right? I have no problem with fishing. I have no problem with hunting. I have no problem with eating the stuff that you're going to bring in from your hunt. I just don't like the mess of it. I have no urge to go out and clean a fish. I have no urge to gut a deer. I have no urge to do any of that stuff. All right. I don't want to skin an animal. I don't want to do even the most basic of field dressing to get the thing ready to take to the butcher. And I know lots of hunters. I know how much they love it, and they have brought me in the products of their work, most often deer sausages, deer sticks, great stuff like this. And I can appreciate what they get out of it, all right? It's a fun hobby, but for that kind of expense, you know, I spend that money on D&D books. I spend that money on gaming stuff and dice and whatever else. I invest that money in my computer and my software. They spend it on guns and ammunition and camouflage clothing and, you know, leasing land to go hunting and all the other stuff that goes with it. That's their hobby. And, you know, and they have fun doing it. Great. More power to you. Not my style. But having said that, back to the original question. Yeah, but I have shotguns lots of times. Pistols, shotguns, rifles. Once, a semi-automatic weapon that I think had been illegally converted. I have no idea. That was many, many years ago, and I only got to fire it the one time. I mean, literally, it was like, oh, feel that. No, go ahead. You can pull the trigger. Or just, oh, darn. All right, yeah, okay, I get it. That was fun. All right. And as it turns out, my experience has taught me that I'm not a bad shot either. I mean, I don't own any guns myself. And the times I've gone out, I've always been with people who are very generous. And so, you know, they provide the ammo and they provide the targets and stuff. And I've kicked in a little money here and there to help out. But for the most part, I'm not investing a lot in the firing of guns. And so therefore, I don't go to the target range. I don't have a lot of time to practice. I don't put a lot of effort into it. But if someone's got a gun and they're like, hey, we're going to go out shooting some Blue Rock today. You want to go with us? Oh, sure, I'll kick in a couple bucks. Let's go. And as I say, what I found out is I'm not a bad shot. I'm not great. You know, I'm not top-notch. But for an amateur, I've had on more than one occasion, you know, we're kicking them out there and I'm popping them off. And I'm, you know, not a bad rate of hit-to-miss ratio here. And I get people commenting on more than one occasion that, wow, you've never done this before? Well, no, not often. So, you know, I'm not bad at it. Maybe it's all the video games. Whatever. I like shooting. Love shooting. Not willing to invest the money in it. Number 88, again from Serious Paul. Let me start over. Wouldn't being a cyborg pirate suck? All that salt air? Oh, dude. Okay, you got to weigh this out, though. Lots of maintenance, lots of failure rate, lots of problems being a cyborg pirate, because you're right, the salt air, the moisture is the enemy. But imagine how badass you would be. Is there anything out there that can be much cooler than being a cyborg pirate? Really? Number 94. This one comes from Rave Master. Oh, God. Rave Master, thank you. All right, before I get into his question, Rave Master sent me a Get Well card because he is that kind of awesome dude. He sent me a picture. You got to tell me, Rave, I have no idea. Is this hand-drawn? But it is a picture of a blue griffin. It's a griffin in flight above the clouds, and it is carrying a Get Well message to me because, of course, I was sick last week and the podcast was late, and so he sent me a Get Well griffin. What did you guys do for me? Nothing. That's what you did. Ravemaster loves me. All right. Anyway, thank you, Rave. It was awesome. I was just overwhelmed. I thought that was spectacular. And Rave asks, have you ever shot a fluid like milk or soda pop out of your nose, either by accident or on purpose? All right. Certainly never done it on purpose. Although I have a brother who can shoot milk out of his eyeballs on purpose if he wants to. He can lay down underwater in the swimming pool and blow bubbles out of his eyes. I swear to God. Creepy. So anyway, but me shot milk out my nose. Oh, tons of times. But see, in my case, it's a little special because you had no way of knowing this, but I was born with a cleft lip and a cleft palate. All right, hair lip, if you want to use the crude term for it. And I've had wonderful, wonderful surgeons. I've had great plastic surgery through the years to repair all of this. I look just fine. At least that's what my wife tells me. I mean, my nose is a little bit crooked. The scar is obvious. But, you know, I have a full lip. I have, you know, all the features are there. So I was lucky that it was not terribly severe and that my repair work was really, really good. Very lucky. But as a result, dude, I was born with a hole in the roof of my mouth leading right up into my sinus cavities. As a result, I can't whistle. I can't roll my R's. And, oh, yeah, especially when I was younger, I don't know what it had to do with the swallowing reflex or whatever else, but milk came out of my nose a lot. A lot. And you know what? And I suppose, technically, any fluid would do it, but milk more often than anything else. Is milk slipperier than regular water? I have no idea. Anyway, yes, I've shot milk out my nose plenty o' times. And, yeah, no, it's not pleasant. No, not at all. Number 66 from Stan. Name your favorite ancient Greek city-state. Well, yeah, you know what? Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so much fascinating stuff in ancient Greece. I mean, you know, clearly you want to give me the obvious answer, you know, Sparta. But you know what? I don't really care much for the Spartans. I love the movie 300. I love the story of the Spartans. But, you know, the Spartans themselves, they were kind of douches, really. I mean, honestly. You know, Troy, you know, I don't know. There's so many. Probably my favorite. I mean, it feels cliche, but it's the first thing that comes to mind. Athens. I love Athens. But that's, I mean, you know, we're talking Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. We're talking the politics of the time, the birth of democracy, the intellectual, I don't know, it was just such a cosmopolitan place and such a center of learning, center of knowledge. It seems like the nerdiest of the Greek states, doesn't it? I don't know. There's a lot to like, and I feel like my answer is incomplete because I almost feel like Athens is just the default answer. You know, when you're picturing classical Greece, you're picturing Athens. I mean, that's just the first thing that comes to mind. And so, or maybe that's just me. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to give Athens as my answer because I really don't have a better one than that yet. Number 78. Ooh. Serious Paul. Serious Paul asks, what would you do for a Klondike bar? Oh, dude. All right. For a Klondike bar, I would pay $1.59 for a Klondike bar if the gas station was out of ice cream Snickers. Yeah, that's about right. Number 36. This is going to be the last one. This one is also from Serious Paul. Serious Paul says, 9 or 13? 13. Have you not been listening? 13 is a prime number. It's unlucky number 13. You can't not love number 13. Love that thing. 9? I mean, 9's not bad, but, you know, it's a composite. It's a perfect square. I don't know. There's something incomplete. Strangely, something about number 9, because you're asking me this question, 9 or 13, and maybe you thought it was a throwaway. I'm taking this very seriously. 13 is clearly a top favorite for me, but when I look at 9, I immediately think, yeah, that's something my brother would like. You know what? My brother Kyle, he's a 9 kind of guy. If you gave him the choice of 9 or 13, I'm pretty sure he would have picked 9. It's his number. It really is. I mean, he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it just feels that way. Man, we covered a lot of stuff today. Before I get to the credits, let's do a quick recap of the entire episode.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is still Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review. Or go over to my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio and just hit like. Come on, you like me. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out the Facebook page, leave us a comment there. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is always come over to nerdprideradio.com/forums, sign up for a new account, send me a message, we'll hang out together, we will have fun. All right, thanks, R2. This is an 80. Our last one is from Stan. And Stan says, name two things that you're a snob about. All right, there's not much. All right, because being a snob implies that I look down on people who don't agree with me, or I look down on people who don't have as, quote-unquote, sophisticated a taste as I do. And I try not to do that. I try really, really hard not to do that. I will say two things that I'm kind of a snob about. Kinda. But not even because I'm not even talking about judging other people based on it. But comedy is one of them. Stand-up comedy. There are popular comics, and again, and it's hard to be a snob about them because, you know, like I'll say Larry the Cable Guy. Larry the Cable Guy, I hear that and I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's base comedy at its worst. It really is. And yet, it's easy to bash on someone like Larry the Cable Guy, but I went and saw the dude in concert. I mean, I paid cash money. You know, me and my wife and my in-laws, we went to see Larry the Cable Guy in concert, and I've enjoyed Larry the Cable Guy's material. You know, the first couple of times I heard it, and then, you know, after you heard a couple of his specials, you realize, okay, well, that's what he's got. Everything else is pretty much the same. You know, so I've enjoyed what he's done. But yeah, it's lame comedy. The stuff that I really enjoy for comedy, I mean, you know, I pride myself on liking people like Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, Doug Stanhope. Doug Stanhope is an acquired taste, but you know, he's an awesome storyteller, spectacular storyteller. You know, you make fun of Larry the Cable Guy, or you make fun of Jeff Foxworthy for his, you might be a redneck crap, but you know, watching the Blue Collar Tour, you know, Bill Engvall is not, you know, there's nothing spectacular about what he does. I mean, he's just a stand-up comic who does funny stuff, and I like Bill Engvall. I like the way he does a story. I love Ron White. Ron White is one of the greatest storytellers in comedy working today. I think the guy is brilliant. But, you know, I can be a little snobby about my comedy. Not much, but a little bit. And then the other thing, and this isn't really, again, it's not a snob. I don't look down on other people for not agreeing with me, but really, Heinz is the only ketchup that exists in my world. I hate it that I'm that way. I mean, I'll eat another ketchup if that's all that they've got. But if I'm going to the store, Heinz is the only ketchup I buy. It's the only one I keep in my house. I don't care if it costs five times as much as the generic brand. I don't care if it's three times as much as Hunt's. I have to have Heinz ketchup. It is the only ketchup in the world. And to go along with that just a little bit, Kraft is the only macaroni and cheese worth eating. All right. Now, I don't put Kraft macaroni and cheese and ketchup together because I actually put them together when I eat them, although I do sometimes and it's really good. But those are two things that I don't often have to go name brand. I'm perfectly happy with store brand on almost everything I buy. I don't really care at all because to me it all tastes the same. But for some reason, Kraft macaroni and cheese is a step above every other generic and store brand I've ever tried. And Heinz ketchup, again, is far and away the leader in ketchup. It's the only one. So those, again, I'm not a snob. You know, you eat whatever you want. If you want to put crap in your mouth, that's your choice. But for me, if I'm paying my money for it, I will not settle for less than name brand on those two items. I don't know why.